Why should it?
Because.
What can appear like concentration? Could be. When we, that's what you brought up then, is bodily, because when we do cling, whatever we cling to, there's a kind of wrong concentration at those moments, and we hold on to the object, sometimes for a very long time, and the same happens with sati. So that if there really is sati, the genuine article, the chances that we'll cling to it are pretty strong, and that is when what might appear to be some form of concentration might appear. One important thing that perhaps you should be said is that even though the moments of being aware are different from the moments of not being aware in a way that can be understood and must be understood, still it would be wrong to think that the moments of awareness are something special, or that something special has to be seen. I think the idea that there might be something special would be a condition for us to be looking for something instead of letting awareness arise more often. Another thing, awareness doesn't always arise at the same level. And we shouldn't forget what the object of developing awareness is. The object is so that we can, in fact, have deeper understanding. It is for the sake of banya that sati is developed, not just so that we can say we have a lot of sati. Banya cannot be expected in the very beginning to see characteristics clearly. So one cannot expect every time there is awareness to have the kind of banya at that moment that knows the characteristics that we're being aware of clearly. Therefore, one can't expect to be able to sit back confidently with banya knowing the characteristics and saying, oh yes, this is sati this moment, ah, sati again, ah, sati again. Because that would mean that you had already reached a stage of sati satana development that was sufficiently developed for banya to know clearly. But in fact, one has to develop sati first before banya can know the characteristics as clearly as that, as often as we would like it to. So we have to have doubts in the beginning because our banya isn't strong enough to tell us that everything's okay. Even using words like everything's okay, I would rather not, but I think we can take it in the right way. One can't expect to have a great deal of confidence in the beginning. I think we are always wanting to take a rest. I think we are always wanting to say, I'm on the path. And if we are wanting to reach this stage, it shows that we don't yet know what being on the path means, because there is no rest. There is no I being on the path that you can sort of relax and say, oh, everything's okay now. Because every time you think everything's okay, you're just holding on to past achievements and there's no awareness of anything at that moment. Okay, for whom? For the jitta that has just fallen away, because that's all there was, or for the jitta that just has arisen? It can't be okay for anybody. There's nobody for it to be okay for. And I think this is a very real desire we have to get, really to get somewhere, even though we discuss in these groups and say, well, we know that when you think you're getting somewhere, it's not the way. We still have this, even while we're thinking perhaps that it's true, that it's wrong to try to get somewhere, we're still hoping. We still have this accumulated desire to find some refuge for our non-existent selves so that we can say, I'm practicing right, thank goodness. But there can never be a moment of really, I'm practicing right, thank goodness. There can be a moment of practicing right, but as soon as you think, thank goodness, you're not practicing right really anymore. You're not practicing at that moment. Yeah. To get back to the very fundamental question, I would like to say that it may be very obvious and maybe you will know it. But, of course, we have to know the difference between the moments with sati and the moments without sati more clearly so that we can know the characteristics of sati. Is that too obvious? How can we know what sati is if we don't know the moments when it's there and the moments when it's not, and we can't tell the difference? And if we cannot recognize the characteristic of sati a little more clearly, how can it be developed? Not that I want to give the idea that the self comes in here, knows the difference, and starts developing it like crazy. You know, now I know what sati is, now I can have it whenever I feel like it. That would be impossible too. But if Paniya doesn't get a clearer idea of the characteristic of sati by seeing that there is a difference between those moments of sati and those moments when there aren't, then just be confusing. To begin to know. Can't we begin to know? Maybe satipatthana is just a continual beginning. Because if we think we've finished, we won't go on being aware. We begin to be aware again. Begin to be aware again. Because after all, having been aware, what happens next? Then to one avitala. And so where are you then? You're clinging and you don't know. Or you have aversion and you don't know. Or you have moha and you really don't know. Not only is moha not known, but you don't know that there's moha. Because if there's no awareness, you don't know it's moha. You may cling to the moha and think it's you. The center one may be some kind of agusala after having been aware. So what can one do after having been aware? And then because of our accumulated agusala, there's no agusala, but begin again. Be aware again. Patiently of whatever it is. If one could say one only ever gets to that refuge when one gives up trying desperately to get oneself to a refuge.
Would it be possible for someone who
didn't understand anything about developing awareness to have a similar sort of experience? Do you think?
Yes.
So it doesn't have to be sati. It doesn't have to be satipatthana. Not necessarily. Can't we change from anger to strong attachment with a pleasant feeling? Without any awareness in between? Why should there be awareness in between? Why should there be any kind of kusala in between? For example, let's say you're quite annoyed or irritated. But then, conditions are such that somebody who's very dear to you, with whom you're not angry. Now, mind you, when you're really angry, it's hard not to be angry with absolutely everybody. But maybe there's a special person is very dear to you, or maybe somebody gives you something that you really like very much, and your accumulated attachment is so strong that you can't resist it, and you find a big smile breaking out, or you're delighted with this thing that somebody's done, and you think, oh, how wonderful, you dear, dear person. Now this doesn't have to be with kusala. It can be, but it doesn't have to be. It can be just very strong attachment to this person and what has been done for you. It may not have even been kusala on the part of that person. That person may have been acting through attachment in doing what it is that he or she has done to make you feel happy. But you may have very strong, pleasant feeling, and you may feel completely relaxed, and you may even turn to the people around, or to the person that's been offending you, and say, look, I'm so sorry, really I am. Without, again, even kusala. Without true kusala, or maybe little moments here and there. But to think there must be sati because one changes from a bad mood to a good mood. I don't think so.
Yeah, but this one is obviously you can
bodily conditions? Which conditions? It doesn't have to be suffering. You mean you suddenly just out of the blue, it's okay, your anger has gone? Ah, well, if there's some understanding, if it really is understanding, it can be a level of suffering, certainly. Certainly. But it still wouldn't have to be satipatthana, would it?
No.
But a level of gusala with some degree of suffering. Like when we are angry, upset with someone, and then we realize that that poor person who said what it is that has made us upset has, without his knowing it, just brought upon himself something dreadful in the future, like maybe being spoken to, like he has just been speaking to you, right? If you can see what he's just done to himself, at that moment you may have compassion for him. Such a level of sati, see, thinking, understanding that the level of thinking, what's really going on, knowing that he isn't causing you to feel unhappy. You're unhappy because of your own accumulated dosa. That's why you've got this unpleasant feeling at this moment. You can see the true cause and effect in this situation is that he's just committed the cause that is going to bring him very unpleasant results in the future. So with that kind of understanding, there's compassion and there's no anger anymore at that moment. There's a change. So with some degree of sati, through thinking about what cause brings what effect, but still doesn't have to be anything to do with knowing the characteristic of reality at any moment. Or knowing that what you hear is your only barter is another way of looking at the same situation and realizing, well, the reason I'm so upset has nothing to do with him. It's all my own fault in the past, obviously. Otherwise, I wouldn't be hearing these unpleasant words. Now, there's another degree of detachment brought about by awareness at some level, but it doesn't have to be satipatthana. We are lucky if we have the kind of gusala citta sometimes that makes us honest enough to see that we don't yet know characteristics very well. We're very lucky because then there can be more suffering, more and more. But if we think that we're okay, or even not as far advanced as that, but just think, well, yes, I know these different characteristics, when in fact, although we don't quite realize it, our understanding of characteristics is perhaps not even got above the ground, if you compare it to a little plant, then we can develop it more, and it can grow. But such a great danger to think that you have accomplished or reached what you have not yet accomplished or reached. And when you know that there's no one to accomplish or reach, then that helps you to realize the true situation. Nothing worse than thinking, you know, I'm there, I can do it. Some degree of gusala is wrong understanding of the true situation. Very common. Heaps of it in the beginning must be, because that's what the banya is being developed for, to eradicate that very thing. Now, if there were nothing to eradicate, there'd be no path. So one shouldn't be surprised to find that one has many moments of wrong understanding. If one actually sees them, begins to see them, one should be delighted. One is not deceiving oneself, but one is sees these moments that one knows must be there. Of course, if one is delighted, let's be aware of being delighted. One can't help being delighted. Being natural is a good thing to bear in mind, helpful thing. That's part of its naturalness. I think you can say yes. But it depends what you mean by surprise. Because there's nothing unnatural about being surprised, but still the characteristic of sati is not something special. So if one can be surprised I think one can be surprised without being misled into thinking that sati is something really strange or peculiar. There can be a kind of agusala that arises, I think, after having been aware to some degree, that might be like a kind of surprise, but not the kind of surprise that you have discovered such a peculiar phenomenon. Not that kind of surprise. But it must be natural. You know, if it weren't natural and ordinary and not special, it would simply condition colossal clinging. The conditions are not clinging as it is. We can cling, and we do cling, to our understanding. But if it were the nature of understanding to condition a lot of clinging, then there'd be no point in developing understanding. Because we would just have more and more clinging every time we understood more. So although you can be attached, and we are often attached to our understanding, it is not the function of understanding to bring about more clinging to reality. Sure, there can be clinging to understanding, but it is not a condition for heaps more clinging to all kinds of realities, because understanding can begin to see that the characteristic isn't what you thought it was. It's not a person. There's nothing desirable about something that is truly uncontrollable. There's nothing desirable about something that isn't there anymore. It really isn't there. Now, if one was having something that one called awareness, that led one to just want to have more awareness, without knowing why, we don't even have to put that on. To just want to have more awareness, because one thinks awareness is good and I should have a lot of awareness, one can hardly say that one is developing detachment. If one lives for being aware, sati is aware of a characteristic, whatever it might be. Banya begins to see it as it really is. That is, as dukkha, for example. But then the sati, the very sati and the banya themselves are characteristics which we have to be aware of too, and have to understand too, because they are also dukkha. You can't keep banya, it's gone. Banya isn't someone. Banya is also dukkha, because it arises, and it falls away, and it's completely uncontrollable. You can't keep it. You can't do anything with it. Bakla. Banya can arise when there are conditions for it to arise, and it can know the characteristic clearly, and then it must fall away. And the more often it arises, the more conditions there are for it to arise again and again and again, moment after moment after moment. But it is banya that attains, it's not us. So in that sense, you're right. We cannot attain banya, but banya can do its own job perfectly well if we let it, if we don't keep on trying to get in there and have it, get it, try to understand, or having understood, go on understanding, or having understood, want to understand again, right away. Because as soon as we want to understand, there are no conditions to understanding. Or, if there is some understanding, there's bound to be attachment to it, because it's just that we claim we have been wanting to develop. And if it's the real thing, and it's what you've been wanting, even though it mightn't be quite what you expect, if you see how valuable it is, it can in a roundabout sort of way condition you to want more of it. Just like we try to have long moments of suffering. We try to be aware for so long, when awareness can only arise and perform its function and then fall away immediately. So no attainment for anybody, but panya can do its job. And just as we can accumulate stronger and stronger attachment when conditions are right for it, so we can develop stronger and stronger panya when conditions are right for it. When one begins to smoke cigarettes, one's attachment is not the same as it is years later. When one has one's first taste of alcohol, if one continues to drink as the years go by, one's attachment is not the same as it is at that very first moment, compared with years later when a man might in fact become an alcoholic, when his attachment is so strong that he becomes a derelict and feels perhaps to satisfy his craving. So there is negative development, and just as there is that kind of development of attachment, so there can be a development of banya. But when we talk about the man having become an alcoholic, in reality, there's no man who wasn't an alcoholic in the beginning and no man who is at that later stage. But at the moment when that man started to drink, there was a certain level of attachment that rose because of conditions. And years later, with all the different types of nama and rupa that had risen and fallen away in between, a single citta arises full of very strong attachment and falls away. So it is with panya. At one moment, only ever, the one citta.
We're
tempting our latent tendencies, yes. No doubt. Associating with people who lie a lot makes it easier for you to lie. Associating with people who study Dhamma a lot makes it easier for you to study Dhamma. Associating with people who, whatever the people around you are, whatever kind of people they are, whatever tendencies they tend to have, their behavior, their tendencies will be a condition for you to follow. Regardless of how strong you are. A tendency, it doesn't mean that if you've lived all your life with wicked people that you necessarily have to become as wicked as they, but the conditions for you developing agusala are much greater than developing gusala, depending on your own strength of accumulation. You can pull yourself out of that situation when you hear, if your dhamma is good enough for you to hear the right word from somebody, to see the dangerous position you're in, and then little by little you can ease yourself out of it. Or you can have, in spite of the terrible surroundings, maybe you have to live with those people for some reason or other, you can still have a more careful attitude than you might have before you realized how dangerous it was. Or maybe you have, because of your accumulation, some intuitive understanding of the fact that you have to take care in this situation. So one never knows then what kind of tendency might appear, might not appear. Amina points out that she feels that it's got to be the other way around. One takes on the project first, and then if the funds are forthcoming, wonderful. The translating will be the condition for the funds. One doesn't wait for, now everything's okay, I've got the money, everything's sure, now I will start. So that will help you to understand the train of thought that progresses through here. You're right, you cannot translate without the possibilities of printing. I would like to tell you what I learnt from Kunshichin. And by the way, for anyone who gets marked at hearing names all the time, like Kunmina or Kunsukin or my name or anybody else's name in this group, and thinks, oh, I don't want to hear about so-and-so, so-and-so, let us not forget that the only thing that's worth listening to ever, when anybody's talking about anything, is what's true. If what's being said is true, and you won't, you'll only know that if you develop sati and banya that's going to be able to tell what is true and what's not. So we cannot help disliking people. It's the most natural thing in the world. And we can't help hearing people talk dhamma and feel, I'm going to use a rude word, annoyed for some reason or other. Not like the choice of words, the mannerisms, the sound of the voice, and sometimes just don't want to hear somebody's name. It's quite natural. But for our own sake, let's not put too great a store on that. Let's realize that it is the Dhamma, if it is Dhamma, that's being spoken, that matters to us. If it's not Dhamma, who wants to listen? Let's forget about it. It's useless. But if there's Dhamma there, take out the good stuff and forget about the rubbish. if you can, forget about the person. I would like to tell you what I learned from Kunti Sin. Now here, of course, if Nina has learned anything, it's not from Kunti Sin, it's from the Dhamma. But we are in the habit of using, talking about people. I was inclined to think like you, but Kunti Sin said, just start, and there will be conditions underlying. No you, no other person, only conditions underlined, Dhammas underlined, Vipassas underlined. In any project you undertake, good or bad, it's just conditions. Different kinds of nama arising because of conditions that think about the project, that begin it if it's begun, that complete it if it's completed. So I want to write a book and I need you to pay for it. There's no you who's going to pay for it. There's no me who's going to do it. There are different conditions. Dhammas, my actions in the past, will bring me the pleasant results if there are going to be any. And vipassas, results, causes and results. And so we have less worries, of course. It doesn't matter if it's printed or not. It doesn't matter if it's... But what happens? It doesn't matter if you finish page one. It doesn't matter. Less worries. It doesn't... We're not taking things so seriously. It has to be like this. I have to finish it by so-and-so, such and such a time. Or it has to be the best Dhamma book that's ever been written. Or there mustn't be any criticism of the way I write, or there mustn't be people who think that it's a bad book, or it mustn't mislead anybody. Of course people are being misled. Of course people won't like it. Of course people will think you're stupid. Of course people will think you're wonderful. Thinking you're wonderful is just as stupid as thinking you're stupid, because there's nobody to be wonderful or to be stupid. To think you're wonderful is a kind of an attachment. To think you're stupid is another kind of perhaps attachment. That's another kind of agusala. Just conditions, it's just Dhamma, it's just vipassa. So, less worries. For everything in our life, not just translating or writing Dhamma books, but for everything, less worries for everybody. Less agusala, not just less worries, but less attachment. Less of all kinds of agusala, less conceit. Less jealousy. Less stinginess. Less of agusala. We never know what's going to happen that can destroy our beautifully laid plans. So we can never be sure. If we think, no, it's got to be like this, 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 before I begin. And we talk about it and we ask people and we get everything, this, 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 and we're very happy and we start. Then there's no reason why one of those factors just can't disappear, change, any time. Who knows, underlined, who can control it? Underlined. We used to think in the worldly way, in inverted commas. The worldly way just means the wrong way. In other words, it's you and me, and it's got to be like this, and it's got to be like that. Wrong, making wrong connections. Thinking this cause will bring that result, when in fact this cause will bring that result. Thinking that attachment makes you happy. Like the man in the first page or two of Nina's book two, I think, who comes to the Buddha when his son has died, and the Buddha says, well, of course, attachment is the source of suffering. And he says, I can't buy that. He says, attachment is the cause of affection, a pleasant thing, and he goes away. shaking his head or something. Didn't understand at all. This is wrong. This is making a wrong connection, not knowing what cause brings what effect. And we do it all the time. Dhamma is more direct in one's own language. And it reminds me of the right practice, underlined. Because often I did not understand deeply enough what I wrote myself when it comes to the practice. I still take knowledge acquired from books for knowledge in Vipassana. I take thinking for awareness. I think sometimes we don't think ourselves capable of a lot of this discipline. We don't think it's possible that we would be able to do things genuinely for the welfare of others. But you can surprise yourself. It can be done. Just as, brethren, the mighty ocean deepens and floats gradually down, hollow after hollow, not plunging by a sudden precipice, even so, brethren, in this norm, discipline, that means Dhamma Vinaya, in this Dhamma Vinaya, the training is gradual. Progress is gradual. It goes step by step. There is no sudden penetration to insight. From the Ninth Handle Sutta, it's little by little by little, very, very naturally. If you suddenly wake up one day with no accumulated wisdom, and in the next moment you have what you think is strong banya, and you know it all, I think again, if I were you. The training is gradual. Progress is gradual. It goes step by step. We forget that every time there is no suffering, we forget that it must be gradual. So if one has accumulated banya to a very high degree, very, very high degree, the next moment of there being banya will mean that banya increases just that fraction. So a person with great banya who hasn't yet got enough to realize nibbana, so, he won't be able to tell that he's got so much more, so much more, so much more. Because just like us who've got so little, we have a little bit more, a little bit more, and we can't tell the difference from day to day. So it's the same for a person who's got a great deal, because he doesn't go from that much to that much. He goes from that much to that much, and he can't tell. And that much, and he can't tell how much banya. Will I make it yet? Am I there? Is it time? Nibbana today or tomorrow or when? He doesn't know. If he's looking out for Nibbana all the time, then he's just static. It can't grow. So the penetration would never occur. That whilst he was writing all about the practice, the intricacies of the practice, the dangers of the wrong practice, the need for care in the right practice, while she was writing all about this in her book, preparing the books that we've been reading, and revising them, and translating them, talking so much about how careful one has to be in the practice, she herself wasn't practicing in the right way, so much of the time. She was writing about practice, and what she said wasn't wrong, as far as the theory is concerned, it's perfectly okay. But she wasn't paying attention to the deep meaning of her own words in the theory. It wasn't her fault. She hadn't accumulated enough wisdom at that time. So the same happens to us all the time when we teach, when we talk, when we discuss, for everybody. We say, be aware, be aware, be aware. Who knows? Does there have to be awareness at the moment you say, be aware? When you're urging your friend or student or whoever, and you're saying, you know, the practice is like this and you have to be so careful, does it mean that the person who's speaking then has no wrong idea of self? Does there have to be sati every time you tell people about the right way of practice? You can say to somebody, colour is not self, it's anatta. Does there have to be a moment of sati then? But there can be. And if we could say, as regards the goal of developing sati and banya, that the perception is nothing to get excited about. It's real and it's valuable and it is the goal. But by its very nature, it's nothing to get excited about. If it were, or if we thought it were, then it would show that we didn't understand what the perception is. This goes back to what I was saying earlier about banya doesn't condition attachment. Well, not in the sense of making you more and more attached to different objects. On the other hand, detachment is nothing to get sad about. Detachment is nothing to feel depressed about. To think, oh, I won't be able to enjoy my life anymore. That would be wrong understanding. You can't stop yourself from enjoying your life when there are conditions for you to enjoy your life. And although it's true that when there is more banya, there is less attachment, it doesn't mean there is less pleasant feeling, because it's not only attachment that arises with pleasant feeling, but it is kusala, with banya, that can arise with pleasant feeling too. When there is attachment, whether it arises with pleasant feeling or neutral feeling, it is the condition for all the unpleasant feeling that we have, all of it. But banya was never a condition in that way for us to have unpleasant feeling. So with banya you get pleasant feeling and no hangover, no unpleasant feeling into the bargain, no rebirth in lower planes, ultimately no rebirth, no death, because no birth, and no unpleasant feeling at all. But with attachment, you get the pleasant feeling, and also you get all the rest. You get all the unpleasant feeling too. You get the aches, the pains, the diseases, the tortures, the horrors. You get anger, you get jealousy, you get all types of unpleasant things. So there's nothing to lose and everything to gain. If you stop trying to gain. But that's one aspect of attachment, or one level of attachment.
But I still quite don't know how I go about writing that to this person, because this person had not been down.
I would like to say that when conditions are right, you'll find the right way to say it. We could put words into your mouth, but it wouldn't be convincing. Well, we've all experienced some level of detachment, haven't we? And we cannot know personally the benefit of a higher level of detachment that we have not yet ourselves experienced. We can only theorize. But the theorizing we've just done is pretty helpful theorizing to see, well, I think as Margaret pointed out so beautifully, that we get pleasant feeling. I don't mean that we should be motivated by our desire for pleasant feeling. But if you want to look at it this way, there is pleasant feeling with banya, or there can be. But it will not ever condition any unpleasantness, whereas the pleasant feeling with attachment always is the prime condition for unpleasantness. So just on that score, which we can understand in theory, we can see the benefit, because nobody likes unpleasant feeling. Not that one develops all of this stuff to get rid of unpleasant feeling, but you know, in a way, that plays a pretty big role in the development of understanding. After all, it's to prevent death, to get beyond death, old age, suffering. And if that isn't primarily unpleasant feeling, I don't know what is. So in a way, we can say our whole motivation is bound up with getting rid of unpleasant feeling. It's just that getting rid of unpleasant feeling is not achieved by making that one's goal in life. In other words, saying right now, I have to get rid of this dosa, because you can't. It's only by understanding that nobody can get rid of anything that one eventually does get rid of dosa. We could talk about detachment on so many, many different levels of understanding. Some of it we will understand very clearly because we have developed a level of banya which knows clearly that level of detachment from our own experience. The rest of it we can approve of or understand to some degree, but it won't be clear until we ourselves have experienced it for ourselves. And we can't help but be a little bit wrong in our understanding in theory. No amount of theoretical understanding can ever match up quite with what the experience itself must be like. I think writing letters to people about Dhamma is a very, very difficult thing. I have terrible accumulations for it. Nina obviously has developed better and better ones. True. Yes. General. So if we are too bound by our desire to get our correspondence somewhere, if we say now, I have to make this person see this clearly, and if we're too attached to getting a certain result with that person, we won't be able to write anything very, very helpful. So we have to have a certain amount of detachment in our correspondence, just like we do in our relationship person to person with people. When we meet new people that are interested in Dhamma, we can't expect them to understand anything necessarily immediately. Depends on their accumulation. Depends on how you put it and whether they're ready for it at that moment. I didn't bring it with me. It reminds me of some very helpful material I've been reading lately on teaching, because we all teach in our life. Every single one of us, every time we meet somebody who's interested in Dhamma and we open our mouths and start talking, we're sort of teaching, answering questions, trying to explain, trying to help. And it's very easy not to have awareness at those moments, just like it's easy to have not to have awareness any time. And we find in the Tipitaka that the Buddha mentions the teaching situation over and over again. Perhaps he knew that people who were developing Dhamma, people who were interested in Dhamma, would always be faced with difficult questions, and so would always, to some degree, be teachers. And so he has talked about teaching over and over again to remind us to be aware of the sorts of things that happen to us when we're teaching. And he describes in the different parts of the Tipitaka, where he talks about teaching, the right way and the wrong way. And to my mind, he doesn't point out what's the right way and the wrong way so that we could read it and think, oh, well, I'm always doing it the wrong way, so I must stop doing it that way and do it the right way. Or we might think, too, I can't teach like that. The way that the Buddha points out is the right way. I'm not pure enough, or I don't have enough understanding to teach perfectly like that, therefore I mustn't teach at all. In both instances, we would be interpreting, I think, the Buddha's word wrongly. I think the reason why he points out the right way and the wrong way, many reasons, of course, but one of the important ones is so that when we read about the wrong way and we recognize that often happens with us, it's just a reminder to be aware, not to try and control ourselves not to teach wrongly, because when there are conditions for us to teach badly or wrongly or to have lots of agusala, you can't help it. But if you remember that it's natural and it must happen, then you can be more aware of those moments. And if you're teaching well, instead of getting terribly conceited about it, there again can be conditions for you to be reminded of the realities of those moments. Because to think that you're teaching well or to think that you're teaching badly in both instances shows that you're not teaching well. So when you realize that you are always hoping that you are teaching well for that person, that could be a condition for us to be more aware of that moment, that it's a kind of nama that is wishing well. It's a kind of nama that wants to succeed. It's a kind of nama, too, that has conceit about teaching. It's a kind of nama that gets upset about failures in teaching or saying something the wrong way or at the wrong time. If you come across any of these, don't skip over them thinking, oh, I'm not a teacher, or I'll never teach, or I can't teach, or I don't teach. Everybody teaches. There's no area of the Kapitika that doesn't really apply to us in some way.